This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If Americans ate a healthy amount of meat, which would be less than most of us eat, that would have about three times the impact of all agricultural carbon sequestration combined.
Can simply changing how and what we grow really make a difference to a changing climate? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, author and agricultural expert Eric Tonesmeyer, is quite certain it can. We discuss smarter agricultural methods like using trees and grazing animals, and we talk about what might turn an enormous, slow-moving industry like agriculture onto a more sustainable path. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Eric Tonesmeyer. Eric, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So your latest book is called The Carbon Farming Solution. It's a very comprehensive look at how agriculture can make a positive change in our environment and hopefully mitigate climate change. First of all, why don't you tell us who your target audience is with this book?
Sure. Initially, I really set out for it to be primarily for farmers, but as I worked on it, I came to understand that there was a real need for a book that would speak to policymakers, funders, researchers, people in the finance world, that the case just really hadn't been made for turning agriculture from a contributor to climate change to a solution to climate change. And for that to be taken seriously. So it kind of became very much making a strong case that could be taken seriously by those kinds of folks, although it's still some farmers like it too.
So backpedaling, why don't you explain your experience in farming and agriculture and how you've linked this with your interest in environmental sciences?
Sure. I've spent the last 25 years involved in sustainable agriculture in one way or another. As a farmer, as a seed company owner, as a farm manager, as someone who provided assistance to beginning farmers, things like business planning assistance and stuff like that for them. So I've been in and around that world a lot. And my emphasis was always on organic type systems, and especially systems that involve trees, that incorporate trees on the farm. I sort of discovered late in the game around 2009 that those systems not only are really lovely for their many environmental benefits and benefits to the farm, but they're also far and away the best in terms of fighting climate change. So I sort of began to retool my career to try and offer this contribution to the climate change conversation, climate change solutions conversation. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So that's about 6-7 years now.
And in this country, what do you see as some of the biggest barriers to trying to implement more sustainable farming practices?
Well, some of it is the mindset of individual farmers. There may be no other group of people as stubborn and individualistic as farmers, which is both a strength and a weakness, I think, of farmers, having been one myself and worked with a lot of them over the years. So part of it is people just don't think that trees belong on their farm, let's say, or they just like the way they do things and they don't want to change. I understand that, but a bigger challenge for farmers here in the U.S. and around the world is that if you want to adopt a new practice, you're really looking at 2 to 5 years before you work all the bugs out and start to make a profit again, whether that's converting from conventional to organic or adding an agroforestry component or whatever it might be. It's hard. You have to take a risk and you have to take a hit for a couple of years. So I think the biggest, even more than getting information or getting access to the right kind of seeds or equipment or whatever, is the financing, helping people get over that that challenge of that first couple of years.
And that's kind of where the big agricultural companies have swooped in and steered farmers, for better or for worse, into
into these monocultural practices, which ultimately degrade the soil.
Yeah, it's really about short-term gain and maximizing profit above all else. And it turns out that after a while, you end up having to pay the bill for what you left out of the equation there. And a lot of agricultural loans operate on a one-year basis instead of a longer-term basis, so it makes it harder for people to do that. With that said, here in the U.S., again, the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service does actually encourage a lot of practices that happen to sequester carbon. And in many cases, they will assist farmers by paying for some of the costs and helping to do some designs for how it should be laid out on the farm. So it's not as though there's no options, but really it's a big challenge for a farmer to take. If you're running a business, and farms are businesses, and if you're kind of living close to the edge, which most farmers certainly are, taking on a major overhaul to your business in order to do something about something as sort of remote as climate change can seem like a big challenge. And the good news is that none of these practices were developed, and I cover about 40 different practices in the book, none of them were developed for the purpose of sequestering carbon. They were all developed because they solve problems on the farm. They increase yields, they decrease pollution running off the farm into water or whatever it might be. Typically, they're mostly developed to increase productivity on the farm. They increase soil organic matter and organic matter or humus in the soil. Gardeners out there listening will understand that humus or organic matter is really one of the keys to success in gardening and farming. And it's about 58% carbon, which is awesome. And then trees themselves or the vegetation above ground is about half carbon if you dry it out. So we're looking at integrating some trees in ways that increase productivity on the farm and improving organic matter in ways that increase productivity on the farm. And by doing so, we're fighting climate change. So it's really a win-win for the farmer and the environment altogether. It's just that these financial barriers are often what keep farmers from being able to implement these practices. Not that there isn't a need for education and access to better plants and so on, but the money is a lot of it. A lot of people would love to implement these things and haven't been able to do so.
Where's the low-hanging fruit for these farmers to really make a difference? And then I want to explore how much of a difference we're talking about.
For, let's say, an annual crop farm, a farm that's growing grains or vegetables or beans or something like that, there are some early-stage things you can do. You can apply compost. You can use crop rotation. You can use cover crops. You can reduce tillage. Those are all things that farmers are already doing, that many thousands of farmers are already doing out there. And those all provide some level of carbon sequestration, a very low level, but it turns annual cropping from an emitter of greenhouse gases to a remover of greenhouse gases just by implementing those basic practices. And by the same token, in a livestock operation, you can sort of optimize your grazing by getting the right number of animals in there and moving them around when necessary, providing a rest period when necessary. And again, that gives a low but significant impact. And the thing is, you know, if you're going with these great big farms with large operations, even if you implement just a very, very minimal practice that only gives a small amount of carbon per acre, you're doing it on a really big scale. So you're still making a big difference. Like I have a friend who has a 5,000-acre cotton farm in Arkansas. And when you implement cover cropping, as they have there, you're having a huge impact on the climate, even if the impact per acre is pretty small. So that's the first round, is, say, converting to organic or incorporating some of these rotations, reducing tillage and so on. That's kind of phase one. There's also lots of things farmers can do to reduce emissions. Like if it's a confined animal operation where animals are in the barn, you can run their manure through a biogas digester. And that's a very, very efficient way to turn methane from a basically a pollutant into a resource. So that would be kind of level one.
We'll be right back.
God into my life that told me that love was surely, surely find a way. Gotta keep on growing, keep on growing, keep on growing. I was standing.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Eric Tonesmeyer. His latest book is The Carbon Farming Solution. It's a global toolkit of perennial crops and regenerative agriculture. So in your estimation, what percentage of farmers need to employ these practices in order to actually make a dent in climate change? Can they make a difference?
It partly depends on how much of the burden is shouldered by agriculture. And the way the numbers work out is that really it doesn't work by changing agriculture alone. We really have to get to a safe level like 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We have to transform agriculture, transportation, industry, the built environment, energy, levels of consumption in wealthy countries like the United States and so on. We really have to change very much about how we live. So agriculture alone is not enough to do it. But you see numbers like recently a paper came out showing that if you did these kind of upgrades on all of the world's cropland, land where crops are grown, you would get about 40 parts per million out of the 50 that we currently have in excess. So that means if you get 10% of the world's cropland, you might be able to get 4 parts per million, which would still be a very, very significant impact, although not enough. Then there are these other practices that have much, much higher rates, 5 or even 10 times higher than these kind of basic practices we talk about. Those require greater changes in farmers' operation, and some of them require greater changes to our food system, so they're harder to implement. But the potential, even if we do it on a smaller amount of land, we could get a much greater impact per acre by doing things like adding some trees into the farm.
When you talk about changing our food systems, can you give us some specifics and how realistic is an idea like this?
Sure. The numbers I like are that if Americans ate a healthy amount of meat, which would be less than most of us eat, that would have about 3 times the impact of all agricultural carbon sequestration combined. So diet change can have a huge impact, huge impact. Also, we currently waste in the United States 40% of all food is wasted, and it mostly ends up in a landfill where it releases methane and contributes to the problem. So if we could reduce food waste and aim for a healthier level of meat consumption, that would be huge. That would have a huge impact. And if you were to combine that then with these carbon sequestering agriculture practices, that would be a very, very, very significant impact. Then agriculture could be said to have done its part, and it would be up to energy and transportation and building materials and so on to go from there.
So, Eric, you were talking about how Americans could really make a positive impact on the environment simply by cutting down on their meat consumption. How much cutback are we talking about here?
Well, I can't give you a specific number, but the papers you read basically say if we ate the amount that was actually recommended by our doctors, so more like a Mediterranean-type diet where you don't eat a steak or a hamburger every day, and you have a certain number of meals that are vegetarian, and then you have a certain number of meals where meat is sort of a condiment, and then you occasionally have a meal where meat is the main course.
That's crazy talk.
I know, I know. And that would have some other benefits for health, and also for, you know, national spending on healthcare and stuff could be really different looking at those scenarios. The thing I would like to say is that there are definitely ways to raise livestock that are absolutely positive for the climate, and often the vegetarian argument does not take that into account. So there are ways to raise livestock that are absolutely beneficial to the climate. But by the time you actually were to, if you were to do those, you end up with less total number of animals, because lots of our animals are fed with annual grains. A third of all the world's cropland is raising grains to feed to animals. Really, ideally, food that's suitable for human consumption should be fed to humans, and animals should eat things like grass and crop residues and food waste and other things like that. It's much easier to change an animal's diet than a person's. They're a lot less picky than we are. So really the highest level you could get to would be for people to mostly eat a vegan diet based on things that grow on trees, which have a very high carbon sequestration rate, and to eat a very small amount of animal products that are grown on land that's not suited to growing food for people. I don't think the prospects of that diet having worldwide implementation anytime soon are likely at all. I'm much more interested in things that actually are likely to work. And I would say that aiming for a healthy diet is not a bad way to go. That's really a win-win kind of solution. And if we're putting a lot of effort into transforming civilization, we need to be doing it in ways that have the most benefit for the most people possible. And good health is certainly a great outcome of climate change mitigation in this case.
In the movie Food, Inc., the filmmakers make a very good case for trying to shut down the current feedlot system. And the problems with it are numerous. One of the defenders of the feedlot system says, what's the matter with making food more affordable for more people? You were just saying, we have to try to help the most people possible. Their counter then would be, hey, we're making chicken and protein sources for billions of people this way, and this is the most effective, cheapest way to get it to them. How would you respond to this person?
Well, on the one hand, it's easy to make things cheap if you externalize the costs of the pollution and whatnot, and don't have to pay that yourself and leave that to the public to pay for you. But in part, it is true that when you actually look at the emissions of those kinds of systems compared with, say, a grass-fed system, they're not really that much worse when you measure it per, say, pound of meat or pound of eggs or pound of milk. Because even though they are very high emitting systems, you know, they produce a huge amount of food. Those animals grow and produce really quickly because they're being sort of supercharged with all this fancy feed. But ultimately, the big issue around livestock is that we're clearing forests to make room to grow more annual crops. And a great percentage of those annual crops are being fed to livestock. And there's no kind of farming that we can do that has a better impact than leaving a forest alone in the first place and never cutting it down. For example, every 3 chickens consume as much grain as would take to feed one person. So you're getting, you know, 3 eggs out of what it would have, out of what a human being could have eaten for their whole day's food. So it's just that livestock production is not space efficient. The amount of grazing land that it requires to support an animal just doesn't offer enough meat and dairy products to feed humanity, given that not only do we eat a huge amount of meat, but countries like China are greatly increasing their level of meat consumption, their percentage of meat consumption. There just isn't enough land to have everybody eat the way that Americans eat. And our doctors tell us we shouldn't eat the way we eat either. So I think the ideal scenarios around climate mean less livestock, and really I think mean not feeding grains to livestock anymore in those big kind of systems, but instead feeding forages and grazing and some crop residues. And for things like pigs and chickens, they can live very happily on food waste. And if we're not going to be able to get our food waste percentage down from the 30 or 40% where it is today, then we should at least be feeding it to pigs and chickens, which is actually what pigs and chickens were fed from the dawn of time until about 100 years ago.
Fame is but a fruit tree, so very unsound, it can never flourish till its stalk is in the ground. So men of fame can never find a way till time has flown far from their dying day. Forgotten while a year, remembered for a while, a much updated ruin from a much outdated style.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Eric Tonesmeyer. So, Eric, you have some interesting solutions outlined in your book. We haven't really talked too much about livestock integration in the past on Sea Change Radio. You also have an interesting section on silvopasture systems. Maybe you can outline for our listeners some examples of how these systems could pose as potential solutions from the status quo.
Sure. As far as livestock integration, really, all livestock was grown in an integrated way, or everywhere crops were grown, they were integrated with livestock, at least, let's say, in the old world, up until the dawn of chemical fertilizer, because you had to have animals there for their manure so that you could have some fertility on the fields. So it's only a relatively recent phenomenon that livestock have been disassociated from crops. One of my favorite examples is throughout the Pacific, you see cattle grazing under coconuts and coconut plantations. The coconuts don't cast so much shade, so there's plenty of nice pasture under there. The cows get a little bit of shade to cool them off, which is nice. And actually, it increases the yields of coconuts, maybe partly because of the manure and so on, but mostly because the cow's grazing the grass down low enough that you can see the coconuts and pick up more of them, and you don't lose them in the tall grass. So there's lots of really elegant livestock integration systems like this around the world that have a positive impact on climate change through sequestration, through reducing emissions, and can increase productivity as well. But my favorite livestock production practice that's climate friendly is silvopasture, which is the practice of planting trees in pastures, usually at maybe a wider spacing, not dense like a forest. And this has, let's say, 5 to 10 times the carbon sequestration impact, the climate mitigation impact of even the best kinds of grazing, as far as we can tell. And it also improves the quality of life of the animals because they have more shade to hang out in. And it increases the productivity of pastures. In Mexico, they found that it doubles the productivity of pastures, which is awesome. More money for the farmer, and that maybe enables us to increase the amount of livestock in our diet without having to do any kind of deforestation. You know, animals in systems like silvopasture still have their own emissions. So a cow in a silvopasture still makes methane every time it burps. However, the sequestration in those systems is greater than the emissions from methane. So even if they're giving off some methane and some nitrous oxide as well from their manure and so on, they're doing a lot more good than they are harm, which is not the case in our livestock production systems today, by and large. And it's not that silvopasture isn't widely practiced. There are almost 1 billion acres of silvopasture in the world today. So it's not like that's a wild and crazy new idea people are just making up. It's a very serious kind of farming around the world. It's just not quite as widespread in the U.S., although in the southeastern U.S. you see quite a lot of it in pine plantations. It's very common to see cows running a silvopasture operation in pine in the southeast. So we just need to see a lot more of that. And lots of places are too dry for there to be trees and pastures. Like much of the West is so dry that it won't support trees. And in those places, better grazing is sort of the highest and best agricultural use in terms of carbon. But where there can be trees and pastures, the data is very clear that it's better off to have some trees in there. And then those trees themselves might be producing products like nuts or fruits. They might be making food for the livestock themselves, or they might be harvested as timber. And then that wood represents a long-term storage of carbon in a building, and you can plant a new tree that starts actively growing and sequestering carbon again. So it's kind of a new way of thinking about agriculture. Even if there are practices we've done for a long time, it makes us understand and appreciate them in a new light.
You're in Western Massachusetts, right?
Yes.
So let's say, in a hypothetical, that you are wandering into a bank, and I'm the banker. I have unlimited funds to give you to get your farm up and going. You have a couple hundred acres there in Western Massachusetts. Sell me on what crops you're going to grow and how you're going to not only make a profit, but you're going to do it in an environmentally sustainable fashion.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, first I'm going to take all of my hilly land or sloping land or land that's not appropriate for growing annual crops, and I'm going to convert it to silvopasture. So I'm going to have productive pasture on those areas, and eventually I'm going to have a timber harvest out of there as well. So that's sort of a longer term investment. In my annual cropping areas that are flatter and better quality, more appropriate for growing annual crops, I'm going to do it organically, which is going to have a better carbon sequestration impact and a nice price premium for my products. And I'm going to intercrop them with various kinds of perennials. I'm going to have strips of grass along the contour to reduce erosion. I'm going to have fruit trees and berries planted out along the contour, again, to help with erosion and also with some additional crops to diversify my mix at my farm stand and my farmer's market. And I'm going to have some timber trees, again, planted out in my fields to have a long-term, very high value capital payback over the next, say, 30 years or so. And one of the reasons that you should provide me a loan with this, besides the fact that my numbers work out, because even though I'm spending money on trees for my annual crops, I'm getting income every year, so I have a good annual cash flow happening, is that increasingly we're seeing consumers care about climate change, and I'll be very consciously branding and marketing my products as climate friendly, which I think is pretty clearly a growth market. So that's why I recommend you should provide me with this loan.
Sold. Eric Tonesmeyer, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jazz's Dad, Tedeschi Trucks Band, and Nick Drake.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.